Hello, Sean here. Welcome back. Welcome to part two of talking about Mats Rosengren and his answer to this kind of strange question about prehistoric cave wall art. Why is it that before 1902, when the existence of prehistoric cave wall art was established in academia, why did it seem that children and uneducated locals were more adept at seeing the figures on the walls than the most studied prehistorians? Last episode, we talked about how Sans de Satuola, the person who first made the claim that the wall art of Altamira in Spain was prehistoric, tens of thousands of years old, why he didn't see it the first time. He didn't notice the figures on the walls until he returned to the cave 4 years after he first visited, with his daughter, who saw the bulls on the ceiling. And we also talked about Dr. Felix Garrigou, who visited Neo Cave and remarked that there were figures on the walls, but never really followed up. He didn't seem to think that they were that important. So even when the most educated prehistorians saw figures on the walls, they didn't really pay too much attention to them, it seems. And we began building up Rosengren's answer to explain all of this. He starts by looking at two ancient Greeks, the famous Plato and his concept of the episteme, which became the foundation for epistemology, the study of knowledge, the philosophy of knowledge, how we know things, and the lesser-known Protagoras and his concept of doxa, which Rosengren prefers. There is a famous fragment of Protagoras's where he says, "Of all things, the measure is man. Of the things that are, that they are, and of the things that are not, that they are not." Rosengren alters this fragment to make it less sexist, more clear, and what he thinks Protagoras meant by this, but even if he didn't, a way of saying it that makes it useful for us and for Rosengren, and for us to answer this question. Rosengren says that we should understand the fragment as saying, "Through logos, humanity truly is the measure of everything. Only that which can be experienced as something is, and that which cannot be thus experienced is not." Last episode, we also looked at a more contemporary figure, Pierre Bourdieu, who uses doxa and doxology. And today we're going to begin with looking at another figure that's more contemporary than Protagoras to attempt the beginning of building a 21st century doxology. The theories of the microbiologist and philosopher of science Ludwig Fleck, writing in the early 1930s. Fleck is a figure who was very neglected during his lifetime, but has since become more and more talked about. One reason for that is probably that he was a bit too early. In 1935, he was already developing similar ideas as Michel Foucault and Thomas Kuhn would develop a few decades later. After presaging developments in epistemology so well that people didn't listen to him, Fleck continued working his day job as an assistant to the famous typhus expert Rudolf Weigel. As a Polish Jew, Fleck was deported to the Jewish ghetto of Lviv when the Nazis invaded, then part of Poland, now part of Ukraine. But the Nazis at some point became aware of his work and deported him again to Buchenwald concentration camp, where Fleck was tasked with developing vaccines for the Nazis with Marian Gipulowski, vaccines against typhus. And amazingly, the pair engaged in sabotage, making effective typhus vaccines for the prisoners and faulty vaccines for the Nazis. They both survived 2 years doing this in Buchenwald, which is pretty amazing. In fact, they almost got caught once because this Romanian researcher couldn't replicate their method for making vaccines and was either one of those like nerds who doesn't understand context and is like, "Well, it's incorrect," and he wrote a paper about it, or he was just a Nazi, I'm not sure. But anyways, this paper became known by the Nazis, and they had to like convince the Nazis that this Romanian researcher was wrong and they were making the vaccines correctly. Anyways, crazy story. But we're going to talk about Fleck's thought, which can of course be delved into much more thoroughly than we'll cover in this episode. For our purposes, to get a grasp of what he means and how his thought can explain these oddities in the history of cave art studies, we'll mainly focus on these two concepts of his, thought collective and thought style. Fleck stresses that knowledge and its attainment should not be thought of as a relationship between the knower and the known. This is the way your average person thinks about learning and knowing, right? Like, if you don't know something, well, it doesn't have to be that way. You can muster up some willpower and get to learning, then you will have that knowledge, as though knowledge is a thing you can possess, like an object that's in the world but can also be in your heads if you learn it. There's this objective reality out there with all this stuff in it, and we of course don't know all that stuff, but if you want to, you can figure it out and put it in your head, like you're at a grocery store, you know, picking things off the shelves, stuffing them in your head. But Fleck says that there's always a third player in this equation. It's not just the knower and the known. There's also the existing knowledge. Whether that's a personal thing, like the knowledge that one person has, or a broader thing, like the knowledge existing in a culture or a field of study, the existing knowledge always plays a role when someone is obtaining or creating new knowledge. Since Fleck uses the term thought collective, though, he's usually more thinking about the second one, whether the collective is a field or just a few people researching together. Thought collectives are like doxa, like we talked about last episode. They're, you know, it's a fluid thing. It's not like something with hard boundaries between them. And, you know, there are thought collectives within larger thought collectives and all that stuff. We'll, of course, get to all this in more detail later. Fleck is interested in stuff like the creation of new scientific theories, and this kind of thinking is never done alone, right? Like even if there's a scientist developing a new theory all by themselves, they learned a lot of their scientific knowledge in schools or books. Like, otherwise, how do you even start to develop something that science would take up? Just to get a baseline, a foundation on which to plant your feet so you can look around, that would take many lifetimes if you're just developing it yourself. Fleck says that this means that knowledge and thinking is a social thing. Not just that last bit, but the fact that there's always three players in the obtaining of knowledge. He says, quote, "Cognition is therefore not an individual process of any theoretical particular consciousness. Rather, it is the result of a social activity, since the existing stock of knowledge exceeds the range available to any one individual." Unquote. Those two concepts I mentioned, thought style and thought collective, have a kind of circular relationship, but in Rosengren's view, this circularity is not like a circular argument, where A is proven by B while B is also proven by a common fallacy, but instead it's a type of circularity that can be meaningful, because it, quote, "shows us just how imminent our epistemological position is, has ever been, and will always be." Unquote. A thought collective is kind of like a doxa, a way of thinking held by a collective, and a thought style is what makes a thought collective what it is, rather than a different thought collective. The circularity comes from the fact that the thought style distinguishes a thought collective from other thought collectives, but the thought style kind of comes out of a thought collective. The thought collective produces more thinking in that style, if that makes sense. The two aspects of thought, the style and the collective, kind of mutually cause each other in a way that Rosengren thinks isn't fallacious but powerful, right? Like imminent. I said that Fleck was a precursor to the more well-known Kuhn and Foucault, but the difference is that thought collectives are more flexible than Kuhn's notion of the paradigm and Foucault's notion of the episteme. Foucault used that word that Plato used that formed the word epistemology. But he kind of used it in an updated way. But Fleck's notion of the thought collective is a little different because Kuhn and Foucault, those concepts are both concerned mostly with like the dominant way of thinking in a society. We can call it the dominant thought collective or something. But Fleck's notion of thought collectives can be made up of a whole society, a whole culture, a whole field, but it can also just be the collective knowledge of two people when they're having a conversation or researching together. In other words, every collective of people has a thought collective. There's always all sorts of thought collectives intersecting, much like how we were talking about doxa earlier, with that questionable example of the hypothetical goth, emo, whatever, high schoolers. Of course, though, those two people having a conversation aren't raised on islands alone. They're both connected to society broadly, and the thought collectives that they create when conversing comes largely from this society and, like, their respective fields and stuff. So maybe it's a little confusing. On the one hand, thought collectives are flexible. Any collective of humans creates a thought collective, but their thought collectives are usually connected to much broader thought collectives. I mean, in some way, humanity in general has a very general thought collective, right? Based on our shared bodies and neurophysiology and planet and sky. There's a way of thinking that's common to all people who can think with language that is distinct from the thinking of the hyperconscious worm persons who live underground on planet Hapusakamaka. Anyways, Fleck develops these concepts in much more detail, of course, talking about stuff like how mood is important for thought styles, just like it is for other styles. All this stuff to whittle the concept down into something really precise and useful for, you know, philosophers. But I'll skip a bunch of that and just read his definition of thought style. He says, quote, "We can therefore define thought style as the readiness for directed perception, with corresponding mental and objective assimilation of what has been so perceived. It is characterized by common features and the problems of interest to a thought collective, by the judgments which the thought collective considers evident, and by the methods which it applies as a means of cognition. The thought style may also be accompanied by a technical and literary style characteristic of the given system of knowledge." Unquote. So that's an interesting line that ties into Sans de Satouwola, when he says, "We can therefore define thought style as the readiness for directed perception, with corresponding mental and objective assimilation of what has been so perceived." Right? Cave art, before Sans de Satouwola, had not been so perceived. We'll get there. Both Fleck and Bourdieu think that this sort of thing, thought style in Fleck's terminology, habitus in Bourdieu's, is relevant to perception, not just conception. Most people living in modernity think of perception as a kind of passive thing, where information from the world comes into you, sounds enter your ears from every direction, light comes into your eyes where you're looking at, smells come into your nose, and of course you move your eyes around, you can lean in close to something and give it a sniff. You do something, but it's seen as mostly passive, I think. Besides basic movements like these, in general, I think people in modernity go like, well, we all have eyes and ears and nose and tongue that are much more similar than different, so you sensing something will be the same thing as me sensing something. There's differences like color blindness, but in general, I think people emphasize similarity. But for Rosengren and Fleck, quote, "The act of perception is never purely passive, but one participates with one's body, knowledge, competence, imagination, and so forth in creating the very objects of perception," unquote. That was Rosengren. I think a good way to understand this is to think about how even if our senses are essentially similar, we're usually in a world that surrounds us, a world in which tons of things are happening all at once in every direction. Even if every human who's ever lived has an identical sensory apparatus to everyone else, what we pay attention to, what we focus on, can be quite different depending on a whole array of things: individual, cultural, historical, professional, what task is at hand, and a lot more. In fact, some scholars have even historicized attention. Like, in other words, they've tried to figure out how attention was configured at some point in space-time, or tried to figure out how it changed throughout a period of time in a particular place. For example, Jonathan Crary wrote Suspensions of Perception about attention from 1880 till 1905. Quote, based on the assumption that the ways in which we intently listen to, look at, or concentrate on anything have a deeply historical character, unquote. Or for a more casual example, there's a book by Alexandra Horowitz called On Looking, 11 Walks with Expert Eyes, where she walks around her neighborhood with a variety of different people, all with different expertise. An urban sociologist, a geologist, a sound designer, a physician, and her child and her dog. And she details how all these different humans and the non-human see the neighborhood in vastly different ways, largely due to their difference in expertise, the difference in the thought collectives they are most involved with, which makes them pay attention to different things. Or the non-expertise of the child, which affords a more free-flowing interaction with the neighborhood. Right? Just like Sansa said to Ola's daughter, Maria. Anyways, back to Fleck. In this view, perception happens due to creation. Perception is a creative act. Not usually consciously creative, but creative nonetheless. Although not usually on an individual creativity either. It's a creativity that involves a collective and already existing knowledge. This can explain why the expert prehistorians had such a hard time seeing the prehistoric cave wall art, because that object of perception that we call prehistoric cave wall art hadn't been created yet. Perhaps children and local guides were less entrenched in a doxa, a thought collective, dealing with caves and prehistory and art, and so they were able to see something new, easier than those who had spent their lives with their nose buried in prehistory books. In a little bit, we'll come across another related case where children again show prowess in seeing in a new way. But let's continue unraveling Fleck for a little bit more. We've gone over thought styles and thought collectives, two sides of his epistemological coin, but there's also this concept of his, a twin concept, active and passive connections. This is another important concept in Fleck's theory. It's not too complicated. The passive connections or passive relations, these are just things within a certain thought style that are just thought to exist. It's the given, as it's sometimes called. The active ones are ones that don't just appear as reality. Instead, people in that thought collective understand that these are created by people. They are active connections, and they bear a trace of being actively created by people. I probably don't know you personally, but if you're a person with internet who understands English and chooses to listen to a podcast like this, you're likely in a similar enough thought collective to me that we share quite a few similarities. Of course, I don't know for sure, so when I come up with examples in this episode, I'm talking about the thought collectives that I'm enmeshed in. I'm talking about my doxa and hoping it applies to your doxa as well, or at the very least that you can understand the example. That was a little pedantic, but let's look at an example of a passive connection. A passive connection might be like the concept of a tree. Most people in my society, in my doxa, think of trees as given. Trees are just out there, part of reality. When we think about trees, we don't think of them as something created by humans. They're just outside, growing, doing their own thing. Only people who are really annoying, also known as philosophical, or people who listen to weird podcasts, only they stop and think and go, wait a second. There's two main types of trees, deciduous and coniferous. Trees with leaves and trees with pine needles. So it's possible that we could have, if history went differently for some reason, never come up with the concept tree, but instead come up with two concepts, one for trees with leaves, one for trees with pine needles. And it's conceivable that in this alternate history, these two types of trees were never unified into a larger category of tree like they are for us today in English. They were just seen as two broad categories of plants, like trees and bushes are for us today. Or we could have created a broader category, where the category of tree and the category of bush aren't separate things, but instead one single category, what we can call trush. In this world, you see what we call a bush, and you call it a trush, and you see what we call a tree, and you also call it a trush. Of course, in this world, like ours, there are many subcategories of trushes, just like there's many subcategories of tree. It's just that the main category is trushes, not trees and bushes, like for us. Does that make sense? This is where the created part comes in, for something as simple as trees. Of course, it probably makes intuitive sense to split up plants like we do, with the category tree. I don't know if there's any cultures with trushes as a category, or ones that don't have trees, just leafed and needled trees as separate categories. But the point is that it's still a creation. We still have to make a choice. There's no objective reason for the concept tree to exist. The concept tree doesn't exist in nature. A whole bunch of what we call trees exist in nature, definitely. No argument there. But there's no natural, neutral, non-human way to categorize them, to make them into objects of perception. From what I've read about this kind of stuff, it seems like cultures categorize things more vaguely or precisely based on necessity, whether that's something more practical, like if a culture builds a lot of canoes out of oak trees, that culture might be really tuned into the different species of oak tree, whereas other types of trees are just called tree. Or something less practical and harder for an outsider to understand, like if a culture has a belief in a variety of river spirits, they might not just call rivers rivers, but might split up what we call rivers into like seven different kinds that look pretty similar to each other, to people not acculturated into that culture. Anyways, you can listen to episode 4.1 for more specifics about this. It gets a lot more interesting. The point that Rosengren and Flack are trying to get at is that no matter how obvious it seems, we're always within human creations. There's no getting outside of it. That's why he says that logos is the measure of things. Humans measure the world with logos. We split it up. We create what we see. So that was an example of passive connections, things that just seem to exist, like it's just common sense, things that comprise the real world out there. But an active connection is something that's the opposite, something that even people who have never cracked open a book or listened to a weird podcast understand to be human creations. This doesn't mean that they're not real. It's more that they're more involved in people trying to understand the world, or maybe not all the time, but that's one version of it. There are many examples from what we've just been talking about, in fact. Like, let's pick thought collective. The concept of a thought collective is obviously created by humans, in fact, by a specific human, Ludwig Fleck. It's obvious to me, it's obvious to you, it's obvious to anyone on the street who I explain it to without them walking briskly away giving me quizzical looks. Nobody thinks about thought collectives in the same way most people think about trees, as something just out there, the given reality. Even though Fleck is pointing out there, saying that thought collectives exist in reality, right? That's the whole point. He's theorizing about what goes on in the world, in reality. And again, it's not wrong, it's not false. The point is that the concept of thought collectives bears the trace of the human creation in a much more obvious way to any human than the passive connections, like the concept of tree or river. After reading or listening about what Fleck was up to, your average person might go, that's an interesting way to think about it, and they might incorporate this concept into their understanding of the world. But the knowledge that it was created never leaves. It never becomes seen as just natural, in the way that the category of tree often is. Something interesting here, something we will tie into cave art and visual perception in general later, is that any set of phonemes, the linguistics word for any sound that humans make with their mouth, any group of phonemes can be used to signify anything. The sound tree could be used to signify clouds, or wagons, or French people, or anything else. There's theoretically no limit. Maybe sometimes there's subtle onomatopoeia, or something like that, where like sometimes words really sound like what they mean. But that's not strong enough to be directly causal, usually. Any word can signify anything in the world. If history went differently, we could have called trees any other sound, like spigoo or trilacours, or anything else. If a couple has a kid and decides to be weirdos and raise this kid to believe that trees are called spigoos, everything would go great until that kid meets other kids who go, what the hell? Like, you can understand the world with any sound meaning tree. Of course, this view of language is very tied to modernity and scientific materialism and stuff. It might not work with your worldview, and that's okay. Like, if you're someone who believes that God invented all the words, then, you know, you do you. Maybe God had a reason for making the word tree, that specific sound. The belief that words are neutral labels is very much something coming out of modernity, or maybe a bit before that with like the Axial Age or something. But, you know, all I'm trying to say is that in many cultures, words are understood to be connected to the world in a deeper way. They're active in some way. In series one, we talked about McLuhan's theory about the word logos in ancient Greece, how it had two meanings. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. But I think this notion really persists in people who don't have these worldviews. Like, people online love to argue about things as though God came down with a dictionary at some point in the past, even if they don't believe in God. Like people go, Obama is a communist. Obama isn't a communist. It's like, well, you know, words are just made up by people. Like, you know, if you're someone who says stuff like believe science or science says there's only two genders, well, keep in mind that science also says that words are neutral labels, arbitrary phonemes that are conventionally agreed upon. So maybe stop arguing like that. Find new ways to yap at each other. Anyways, the same thing applies to graphemes. Rather than the sounds you hear, graphemes are visual things, like letters on a page. The word letter is kind of implying an alphabet, usually, or at least a phonetic script. So grapheme is just the technical, broader term, where it can include things like hieroglyphics. Anyways, but that's for later. Keep this in mind. We'll come back to this. But the reason I'm bringing this up now is that it relates to another twin set of concepts of flex: absolutely motivated knowledge and relatively motivated knowledge. Absolutely motivated knowledge is the first person to ever make a word for trees. The person who was scratching their chin, choosing between spigoo and tree. I'm being a little silly there, that's obviously probably not how it happened. But Flex says that once that choice was made, you can't apply the sound tree to something else in an absolute way, in an independent way. And you can't come up with a new word for trees in an absolute independent way either. Both of these tasks will have to be made in light of the connection someone's made between the word tree and those plants that fall under that category. They are relatively motivated, and this is the same with knowledge. Fleck, though, he thinks all things are like this. All knowledge, at least all knowledge that we interact with. Maybe at some point in the past there was absolutely motivated knowledge, like maybe people were thinking about what to name things in that example, choosing between spigoo and tree. But at least all the knowledge that we interact with today is relatively motivated, Fleck says, created in relation to previously existing knowledge. Knowledge is always created, but that creation is often hidden, the way it is with trees. When it's your own thought style, at least. When encountering thought styles that you aren't well versed in, they can seem, like, insane. Rosengren offers a good analogy for understanding this. He says that words have the exact same thing going on as knowledge. Whenever a new word is created, the only way to create it is with other already existing words. Like, it's that whole thing about dictionaries, how words are defined with other words. It's kind of circular. So Fleck thinks that any new knowledge, any new scientific theory, anything like that, it has to be created using the already existing knowledge kind of like how dictionaries use already existing words whenever a new word is, you know, pops up, some slang term. Does that make sense? And this is the link to perception. I'll read a quote from Rosengren summarizing, but as I read, think back to series 2, those episodes on objectivity, if you listen to those. Rosengren says, quote, "We perceive that which we are able to perceive, given the abilities we have acquired through education, physical and mental training, habit, and praxis. The novice looking into the microscope is not able to discern what the trained scientist has learned to see." But the process, transforming a novice into a fully fledged scientist, is not a process wherein an individual learns to see all that there is to see. No, the individual learns to see what is supposed to be there to be seen, which is a highly relevant factor in explaining the reluctance or even inability among the 19th century archaeologists to perceive the paintings in the caves first as paintings, then as Paleolithic. Unquote. Seeing what you are supposed to see has an opposite side, right? You must also ignore what you are supposed to ignore. The world around you always has tons of stuff happening. You have to ignore most of it if you have like a focused task or focused thing that you're concerned with. The scientist being trained to see is at the same time being trained to ignore. The final ingredient, maybe, hopefully, to understand Fleck is to understand that he doesn't see humans as individual units contained within social relations, but something inextricably intertwined in social relations. The human outside of this is like those feral children you hear about who grunt when they're found and barely learn how to speak when they're taught. It makes more sense, Fleck thinks, to define the human as inherently social, inherently tied to a language, a history, a society, except of course in exceptional cases. So tying this all together, we can see how Fleck allows us a way that is different than naive objectivism or complete relativism. All knowledge is relatively motivated, created in reference to previous knowledge, not in reference to absolute reality, something we don't have access to because we are fundamentally social beings, not individual units. And even if we were, that's not how he thinks perception works. But Fleck makes sure to remark that truth isn't relative or subjective, at least as those words are usually meant. I can definitely see, like, you know, Jordan Peterson or whoever saying it's relativistic because it isn't Christian or whatever, but what Fleck means is that truth is not simply based on convention. Truth isn't something that could be anything, as long as the thought collective agrees to it. He says, quote, "Truth is not a convention, but rather one in historical perspective, an event in the history of thought, and two, in its contemporary context, stylized thought constraint." Unquote. That might not be super clear yet, but another way to maybe understand this is to understand that the same thought in different thought styles and thought collectives is not the same thought. It's also a little hard to understand because we think Fleck has the same motivation as other people who believe that we can access objective truth, absolute reality, that we can escape Plato's cave and the earth and our bodies and merge our mind with the absolute light of the sun. Fleck isn't trying to figure out a way to weasel between thought styles and collectives or play them off each other to get to absolute truth. Rosengren says, quote, "To speak of truth is not just a question of how to determine which truth value, true or false, one should ascribe to a certain thought or statement. Such truth questions are inseparable from questions relating to worldview, notions of selfhood, conceptions of life, of death, and of how to think. Every fact and every truth must be expressed in the style of the thought collective." Unquote. There's a lot more to Fleck, even just in Rosengren's summary of him. Right now I'm going over a summary of a summary, but I hope I'm making enough sense for you to get a rough idea of what Fleck is arguing. I'll read a summary from Rosengren to really drive it home. Quote, Fleck argued that facts, truth, and knowledge are, in general, always dependent upon some collective and its thought style. In a way, there are nothing but contexts, nothing but thought collectives and styles. But they have never been, nor will they ever be, delimited in such a way as to allow for the rigorous determination that the traditional notion of knowledge, episteme, demands. Once again, we are left with doxa and all the effect of knowing that we live in and through. This is a crucial point, both for Fleck and for doxology. Being left with doxa does not mean being left with chimeras, or nothing but the semblance of reality. No, in each doxa, in each thought collective, we find an objective reality, sometimes contested, other times not, having real, concrete effects within the collective. And not accepting this reality has, most of the time, very real consequences. The stability of this objective reality is dependent upon the stability of the doxa, of the thought collective and the thought style, and not on the presumed stability of the world out there. Though it may seem both rational and tempting, we cannot even conclude that since most thought styles and doxae seem to accept some basic facts concerning the world and human society, for example, our need of food and water for surviving or of air to breathe, that consequently these facts or opinions represent the real world. The only thing we can say is that since most of us seem, this word is crucial here, to accept these facts, then we may, in an admittedly vague and rather uninformative way, be said to belong to the same thought style or doxa, at least as far as agreement upon these very facts goes. But in no doxa, nor in any thought style or collective, do we have access to the real world." Unquote. I hope that even if you're someone who is convinced by Jordan Peterson's style, weepy defenses of objective truth, yeah, he's still going to be our punching bag this episode, because I can't punch him in real life without losing my freedoms for some reason. What happened to men? Am I right? But even if you're someone convinced by that sort of thing, I hope you can see that Fleck isn't saying that since we don't have access to absolute truth, since all we have is the human, we're just floating in a meaningless universe, disconnected from everything, not able to ascertain anything at all. And I hope you can see the power in this way of thinking. If you just go about life as though we all can access objective truth, and your worldview happens to be pretty close to objective truth, coincidentally, certainly much more close than those weird people over there, then you kind of go down the road of thinking that those people are stupid or crazy or lying through their teeth or, you know, well, something is wrong with them. You do the interpersonal version of Western nations bombing Afghanistan for 20 years and being constantly confused when a lot of the people there don't really get this whole democracy thing and also don't really like being bombed for it. Like when I listen to Jordan Peterson weeping about relativism and saying that the most important thing is to defend objective truth, it doesn't make one lick of sense to me because I'm not in his thought collective of being a Jungian and a Christian. You know, this is the point. It's nonsensical to me, but Jordan Peterson weepily talks about it like it's obviously the truth, and talks about people like Rosengren and Fleck as though they're like Soviet agents trying to destroy every single thing that he likes. If he sat down and actually read some of these scary postmodernists, maybe he'd be like, maybe people think about new things in terms of what they already know. Maybe different collectives of thinkers have different styles, And maybe he'd find a way of talking that would actually make a little bit of sense to people who aren't, like, emotionally drawn to Jung and modern-day McCarthyism and Christianity. And maybe we could actually, you know, talk, discuss, rather than just yapping at each other like chihuahuas from different thought collectives, and then smugly looking back at those who share the same general doxa for approval. Sorry, I'm really ranty this episode, but, you know, if I always have to see that guy being offended about various things, weeping, when I'm just trying to scroll on the goddamn internet and see my friend's posts, then I'm going to use him as a punching bag in my examples. I think that's only fair. Anyways, let's go back to the caves and I'll try to calm down. We can say that prehistoric portable art was in style because it was already known about. But prehistoric wall art was not in style until 1902. Rosengren says that maybe Sans de Satouilla was lucky he was only an amateur archaeologist. Maybe that meant he was a little bit outside of the thought collective that people like Emile Cartelac were much more enmeshed in. We can also bring up this concept of conceptual spaces, something developed by Peter Gardenfors, a cognitive scientist. It's a pretty easy idea to understand, that we connect the concepts in our heads to things in the world based on what seems like the closest match, instinctively, without consciously deliberating about it usually. And we can think of concepts of having a space, metaphorically, like the space of the things that fall under that concept. The concept of a dog contains all the different dog breeds, some of which most people know and can more finely divide up the concept of dog, and the concept dog is nested in concepts with even larger concept spaces, like mammal and animal. When young kids learn about the world, their concept spaces are much less fine-grained than adults. So they often apply concepts to new things in ways that seem comical to us, like calling a horse a really big dog, if they've only been introduced to dogs and a few other animals that aren't horses. The concept of dog seems instinctively to be the closest match, because the child's concept space of animal has much fewer divisions than the average adult. It's less fine-grained. And the average adult has a less fine-grained concept space of animal than a zoologist or zookeeper. You can see a similar thing with inventions in history, like how when cars first came out, people called them horseless carriages. Horse-drawn carriages were the closest match that people could instinctively come up with when they saw cars for the first time. But as cars became more and more popular, they became more and more their own category. Rosengren connects Peter Gardenfors' concept of concept spaces to cave art, saying, quote, "One part of the explanation as to why the scientists did not see the paintings in the caves as readily as one would have expected may be that they simply had too fine-tuned and far too diversified conceptual spaces in relation to art in general, as well as to the Paleolithic portable art, to be able to make the connection. They simply could not find any obvious closest match to what they saw, and hence could not categorize it. There are drawings on the wall. What could they possibly be?" as Garrigou wrote. In Gardenfors' terms, one may perhaps describe the archaeologist's non-perception of the paintings in the caves as a case of failure to categorize their experience as a Paleolithic art experience, while at the same time they were aware of, wondering about, and gathering propositional information about the paintings, though only in terms of drawings or markings in general. So even if the archaeologists obviously saw something, they did not perceive this something as meaningful, or at least not meaningful in relation to their scientific interests. Consequently, they did not take heed of what they saw and soon forgot all about it. Unquote. This is one answer to the question that's the title of this episode: why local, non-expert guides and children seem to be better at seeing cave art before academic acceptance of it. The 8-year-old Maria Satuola truly saw cave wall art for the first time in a modern context. The idea is that Maria's conceptual space of the concept art is much less fine-grained than Sans de Satuola, who, as an amateur archaeology enthusiast, had a less fine-grained conceptual space of art than an eminent prehistorian like Emile Cartelac. And, you know, not just the concept of art, of course, but also other things involved in prehistory. When conceptual spaces are less fine-grained, this means that it's easier to match new things, right? In this case, easier to match this art that's, you know, not in a gallery, not on a wall, not framed, to the concept of art. The conceptual space of a concept in the mind of an expert on that concept is so developed that it can be a hindrance to recognizing new forms of that concept or looking at things in a new way. You can imagine this with a physical metaphor. The conceptual space of the expert on that concept becomes this intricately structured thing, divided super finely so that everything we know of that falls under that umbrella of that concept can be organized with incredible precision. Like an expert in art history has a conceptual space of visual art, where they can look at a painting and be like, oh, well, that looks like a painting by one of those English painters from the 1850s who were inspired by the Romantics and the British landscape painters contemporaneous to them, but developed a use of color and line that, do you see that right there? That it became important, an important precursor to the Impressionists in the subsequent decades. Though I don't believe that this painting is by the foremost figure in that loosely defined movement, J.M.W. Turner, because throughout his career he, and then they launch into even more specifics. So specifics that I can't even pretend to be them. To be an expert, you develop a conceptual space of the concept you focus on that is what I've been calling fine-grained, but maybe I should make what that means more explicit. For this hypothetical expert in visual art history, the concept of visual art has all these subcategories and sub-subcategories, different types of visual art, different time periods and cultures with visual art traditions and styles, different individual painters, and tons more, as well as relations between all of these subcategories. This is what it means to have a, you know, intricately structured conceptual space of the category visual art in this case. Being an expert in a topic means that the concept space of that topic is intricately structured, so the expert knows in great detail how all the known individual examples of that category fit together. But that means they might not be ready to accept new examples that are different enough from every known example, like cave wall paintings compared to all paintings known about in the mid-1800s. Or similarly, such an intricately structured concept space makes it hard for the expert to accept a new framework to understand that concept. We can use a metaphor, like somebody imagining a house, right? If you imagine a house with, you know, kind of just like regular house shape on the outside, something in the back you don't even worry about, and then, you know, it's divided up into a few rooms. There's a living room, kitchen, two bedrooms, a basement with a radiator that's a little creepy. But, you know, it's not super detailed, this imagined house. Compare that to like a house that some savant who can imagine every single detail of this house from all sides. Every room is like mapped out as though he has like a blueprint in his head. After these two people have imagined their house, and you ask both of them to like add a bathroom or something to their house, the person who is much less adept at imagining, they go, oh, okay, maybe beside the bedroom in the upstairs. That's, you know, bathroom would look nice there. But the savant with this, like, blueprint, this intricately structured, detailed house where everything is perfectly, everything's imagined in such fine-grained detail. He goes, oh my god, a bathroom? Fuck, okay, well, it can't go up the upstairs because there's a load-bearing beam there that, you know, it's a lot harder to fit something new into this very detailed, imagined house. Does that make sense? So, similarly, when you've read so much about a certain framework developed by a field to understand their object of study, or even been involved in developing that framework, it takes a ton of work to reinterpret everything you've known in terms of a new framework, or to add something new. But people who haven't done all that work, people who have a less structured concept space and a less developed framework for understanding the concept, they find it a lot easier to go, oh, okay, well, maybe that other way of understanding it's true. Or, maybe that new thing is part of this. I don't know. Like, I've seen this maybe most obviously play out recently with archaeologists and that Graham Hancock guy. who argues that there were civilizations existing before the ones generally accepted in the field. I don't really want to give my, you know, opinions on him right now. I haven't read into him that much. I'm off put by him, just looking at a few interviews. But the point is that it's so much easier for your average person online to accept his version of prehistory than it is for archaeologists, because they have this complex framework in their heads. Their concept space for prehistory is so intricate. And I said I wasn't going to give my opinion, but I should mention that on an intuitional level, I'm not a big fan of Hancock. Even though I love reading about alternative archaeological theories, but like, I feel like if they're true, I don't think Hancock really acts or talks in a way that's helpful for changing mainstream opinion. It's a way of, you know, it's very effective for him making money and getting attention, but it doesn't seem like he, like I'd love a show on Netflix where he sits down with archaeologists and they talk about things. And that would be my preferred show. But then again, I haven't done a deep dive into him, and someone was telling me that he became more and more caustic as time went on, so, you know, I don't know. And I'm also not saying that Graham Hancock is right, even though, you know, in this example, there's an analogous structure to the rigid academia not accepting cave art and sans de Satola arguing that prehistoric cave art exists. You know, I'm saying that only the structure is analogous. I'm not saying that, you know, in terms of who's correct, it's the same. It's just an example that comes to mind. You know, an example that shows that people who have less experience, less expertise, are much more willing to accept novel evidence or interpretations. And, you know, could it be that they also perceive in a different way? Does it go down to that level? Remember how we were comparing Félix Garrigou and Sans de Satola? Garrigou was an expert prehistorian who saw the cave wall paintings but didn't conceptualize them as such, making mention in his notebook and then forgetting about them. Whereas Sans de Satola didn't even see the paintings at Altamira that now seem so obvious until his daughter pointed them out. What we just went over, this notion of concept spaces, that definitely applies to Garrigou, since the example involving him concerns the level of conceptualization. He saw the cave art at Neo and paid close enough attention to note it multiple times, but, and you know, we have to make some assumptions here, but it seems like since the field he was a part of, the field whose focus is ancient people, didn't have any concept that would be a close enough match to the cave wall art in front of his face, he kind of forgot about it. Garrigou was a physician and hydrologist, as well as being a prehistorian. Someone involved in a few different intellectual thought collectives, something easier to do back then than it is now because of, you know, all the intellectual fields had less intricate frameworks and less data back then. Garrigou seems like he was a well-regarded prehistorian. He wrote quite a few books in the 1860s about caves in the south of France, with titles like The Stone Age Caves in the Valley of Tarascon, and The Era of the Reindeer in the Basse-Pyrénées Caverns of Espalung. So he was probably somebody who kept up with the field, reading journals and corresponding with other experts and maybe going to conferences. He was someone who knew all there was to know about prehistory, according to the field at that time. But when in the caves, maybe Garrigou forgot that last bit. You know, maybe he mixed up all there was to know about prehistory according to the field at that time with all there is to know about prehistory. You know, the current existing knowledge of a field sort of directs the attention of the expert when examining a new site or object. Rosengren says, quote, "The would-be scholar is, as Fleck has shown, molded and shaped into a full-blown scientist, not only by acquiring the necessary knowledge or the requisite methodological competence central to the discipline, he or she has to acquire much less obvious and therefore much more elusive selective ways of perceiving and describing the world, a style of thought and expression, as well as ways of being in this world. These latter competencies are no less created nor less required by the discipline than are the former ones, but scientists tend to mistake them for the way things are, or the only rational way to be or behave, and consequently do not question them, at least not on a regular basis. The selective, educated, in-style perception is thus often mistaken for neutral and passive perception, for seeing what there is to be seen, and hence there is no real reason to question it. Unquote. This is where we get closer to the case of Sansa Satuola, back to something we talked about a little bit ago, as well as in Series 2, if you want to learn more about how scientists learn to see. It's a good series to check out. Becoming an expert scientist involves learning to see in a specific way, a way that's both about what to look for and what to ignore. Something Rosengren returns to repeatedly is this popular, well, it's called an optical illusion. I don't know if it technically is, but it's that image of a drawing that's either a rabbit or a duck, depending on how you look at it. I feel like most people in my culture have come across that, even if they don't read much. Hopefully that's true, but, you know, if you haven't, you can Google duck-rabbit drawing and see it for yourself. It's a really cool thing. One of those things that gets more interesting the more you think about it. The first cool thing is that when you look at it, you can, at least if your cognition is like mine, you can kind of consciously switch between seeing a rabbit or a duck. And it's almost like it's hard to see it as a rabbit and a duck equally at the same time. It's kind of weird, like you can see a rabbit and then understand how the duck is also seen. But I don't know, it's like it's hard to see it purely as both, as a pure superposition of both. One is always slightly ground and the other slightly figure, although that gap can be closed to some degree. But the first thing to mention, in line with this whole episode, is this feature of the duck-rabbit where you can choose which one to see. It's an example where our thinking affects what we see. We can consciously choose whether to see a rabbit or a duck in that moment, looking at the image. If Rosengren and those he draws upon are correct, this is the case with our perception generally. This is just a case where it's hard for our mind to hide its role, since it's a conscious choice that affects our perception, rather than the more common and subtle versions, like our attention being drawn to some things and not to others, due to the thought styles we're enmeshed in. This is one where it's a lot more obvious. The duck-rabbit drawing is also actually a great way to explain Rosengren's doxological view. Remember last episode, Plato's argument against Protagoras? How in one of his dialogues, Socrates goes, "Hey, so that dumbass Protagoras says that of all things the measure is man, of the things that are, that they are, and of the things that are not, that they are not. But when a man is sick, wine tastes bitter, and when they're healthy, it tastes sweet. It can't be both, therefore Protagoras is wrong." The duck-rabbit drawing is kind of a similar case, right? But instead of relying on sickness to alter perception, it's just our mind. One person can see a rabbit 1 second, and a duck the next. Man can't be the measure of all things, because that's a contradiction. just kidding, of course. Remember Rosengren's alteration of Protagoras' fragment that made it both less sexist and less confusing? Clearly saying to the modern person what Rosengren thinks Protagoras meant, or at least the interpretation of his fragment that can be useful for us today. Instead of all things the measure is man, Rosengren changed it to, through logos, humanity truly is the measure of everything. Only that which can be experienced as something is, and that which cannot be thus experienced is not. And then we talked about how with this interpretation, Plato's counter-argument can be pretty easily overcome. We imagined a traveler from deep in the Amazon arriving in ancient Greece and learning about this strange liquid called wine. What humans are the measure of is not the true objective taste of wine, but the fact that, out of all the individual examples of liquid, of edible liquid, of varieties of wine, and out of the swirling chaos of reality, we carved out a section of reality via logos and called it wine. It might be a less instinctive choice, but it's conceivable that an influential orator in ancient Greece could have given long speeches for weeks on end about how different red wine is from white wine. How, in fact, they're so different that we should abandon the word wine and come up with two unrelated words for red wine and white wine. They're so different that we need two different concepts. We need to abolish the concept of wine by dividing it into two. This might seem like a weird thing to imagine, and maybe there are different cultures that developed wine independently, and none of them have ever adopted this schema or something. But you can imagine that the arguments of the orator in ancient Greece were like tied to the gods in some way. According to the myth of blah blah blah, red wine is the blood of Zeus, yet white wine is mentioned nowhere in the divine myths, nor in those less formal tales told by travelers in the taverns. You know, imagining that is a quick way of understanding the creative power of humans. Like, when you think of a hypothetical example like this, with foreign categorization, usually there isn't an obvious reason for it. Like, it makes intuitive sense to see wine as one thing, and red and white as versions of it, as subcategories. But religion can be a shortcut for developing foreign categories, like a foundation for strange categorization. You can imagine that something arbitrary can be important and lead to categorizations that seem weird. Like how the shape of a cross is a much different thing in the Levant and Mediterranean world in 300 BC compared to 300 AD. But in history there are other reasons, obviously. Like the thing I talked about some episode a while ago about how Newton divided the spectrum of visible light, the rainbow, into seven because that was a lucky number, both to him personally and to his culture at the time. That's why people don't just say purple, they say violet and indigo, Roy G. Biv, as though those are two of the seven most popular colors in English. like nobody ever calls anything, look at that violet thing over there. Like nobody says that. But Newton divided it up in this way that still sticks around for a fairly arbitrary reason. Applying all of this to the duck rabbit shows us how Protagoras' fragment can be involved with perception, not just with conceptualizing our perceptions. I don't know what Plato would say about it, but if he kept the same argument he used regarding wine, it obviously doesn't make sense, since the image is both a rabbit and a duck. With the wine example, though, the average person might go, yeah, Protagoras doesn't make any sense, Plato's right, wine is objectively sweet, but sick people have their senses altered. The sick wine drinker doesn't experience the wine as objectively as the healthy wine drinker does. But if Plato applied the same argument to the duck rabbit, I think the average person would be less swayed, less convinced. Although it would still be easy to come to a conclusion more in line with Plato and episteme than Protagoras and doxa. I think the average person might say something like, well, objectively, it's an image of both a duck and a rabbit, because that was the artist's intention. And it's not really a contradiction like it would be if you saw an actual beast walking towards you that seemed to be the superposition of two different creatures, some rabbit duck, like horror movie-like walking towards you. Now that would be an epistemological and metaphysical conundrum, but this, not really, because the artist intended it to be ambiguous. But if we apply Rosengren's interpretation of Protagoras to this, we see that the issue isn't what the picture objectively is, but rather the fact that it isn't enough to sense the world. We have to make sense of our sensations. We come back to what we talked about a few episodes ago, seeing something as something else. Protagoras is saying that humans, being the measure of all things, means in this scenario that we've not only divided up the animal kingdom in a way that yields both the category of duck and rabbit, but also that we've developed ways of reading images. We talked in series one about all these episodes from history and anthropology where a person from a culture with photography and linear perspective, the ability to make a 2D painting look 3D, going to a culture without that and finding that the people there don't really know how to look at the images. It's hard for them to make sense because they haven't learned these conventions, these ways of seeing as. What makes complete sense to people from those cultures of first linear perspective, then photographs and motion pictures, and now phone cameras, does not make much sense at all to people from cultures without any of these and without any interactions with those cultures. So, in a similar way, we only see the duck rabbit as a duck and a rabbit, depending on what we choose, because we have certain conventions about how to show ducks and rabbits on 2D surfaces, if that makes sense. It's really hard to wrap your mind around until you start going through the examples and studies, because seeing a photo of a dog and being like, that's a dog, seems so incredibly natural to people raised with photographs. So maybe we should dig into one example, just so we get a specific understanding of this. So we're going to start next episode traveling to Papua New Guinea in the 1950s and looking at a very interesting episode from anthropological history. See you next time.